The administration is clearly hostile to international students in general. Second, the Chinese readout says, quote, the U.S. will continue to support the One China policy, the one specific policy mentioned in the U.S. readout. But while One China is a long-standing official U.S. policy, in practice, the U.S. continues to provide substantial military and political support to Taiwan at a time when Taiwan's new president frequently refers to the country's sovereignty. That is why Xi, according to the Chinese readout, quote, emphasized that the U.S. should prudently handle the Taiwan issue and avoid letting an extremely small number of Taiwan independence separatist elements drag China and the United States into a dangerous situation of conflict and confrontation. Neither readout mentions China's restrictions on rare earth exports, a key issue in trade relations with the U.S. and many other countries. Yet Trump wrote on social media as though the issue was being resolved. He said there should no longer be any questions respecting the complexity of rare earth products. We had a very good talk and we've straightened out any complexity. I think we're in very good shape with China and the trade deal, unquote. You would think that the U.S. readout would have mentioned this win for Trump. The fact that it didn't suggests that straightened out hardly reflects the actual situation. The Chinese response most likely was a matter of wait and see what Trump offers in return for resumption of rare earth exports. Any notion that a breakthrough has occurred on trade or that bilateral relations have now been significantly reduced is simply wrong. The best that can be said is that the two sides are talking. A second round is scheduled for June 9, rather than engaging in competitive tariff hikes and playing the blame game. The main sources of current tension, which include Taiwan, tensions in the South China Sea, Chinese aid to Russia in the Ukraine war, fentanyl, people-to-people exchanges, and human rights, as well as tariffs and trade, are no less serious now than they were before the Trump-Xi conversation. Prior to his call to Xi, President Trump wrote on Truth Social, quote, I like President Xi of China, always have and always will, but he is a very tough and extremely hard to make a deal with, all in capital letters. True enough, and unlike Trump, Xi is also consistent and determined in his messaging. He told Trump, quote, China is sincere and principled. The Chinese people always keep their promises and follow through on their actions, unquote. That statement was both a commitment to hard bargaining and a dig at Trump's erratic tariffs and his unclear trade policy. If the U.S. is going to get anywhere in these talks with China, Trump will have to get his own house in order, a task that is more daunting by the day. I'm Mel Gertow for the Global Citizen. Thanks very much for listening.
You're listening to a summer membership drive special of the KBOO Evening News. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call or text us with your breaking news stories and tips at 971-801-1378. Our production team for tonight's newscast is Josh Salem. Our producer is Hannah Francis, and our engineer is Otto. Special thanks to Edwin J. Vieira, Brian Bull, Isabel Charlet, Mike Moen, Pearl Stark, and Dr. Anthony Leisowitz. The interim evening news director is Hannah Francis. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Eric Leuschner. All our KBOO programs are made possible by support from our members. KBOO is currently in our summer fundraising drive, and our goal is to raise $50,000 by June 29th. If you'd like to become a member and support our programming, you can go to kboo.fm/give or text KBOO to the number 44321. Stay tuned now for Coast Range Radio.
Welcome to Coast Range Radio. I'm Michael Gaskill. So I'm willing to bet that most Oregonians don't know who our state treasurer is, much less what the state treasury does. But we should. The office of state treasurer, currently held by Elizabeth Steiner, by the way, is a powerful position and invests a huge amount of public money. How that money is invested matters, and it really matters that our public dollars and pension funds are deeply invested in the fossil fuel industry. The statewide coalition, Divest Oregon, has been calling out the Treasury's dirty investments for several years now, and they've also put out policy proposals, research, and legislation to shift our investments to help foster a clean energy economy. I'm delighted to talk with two of their members today about the work they do, how it affects all Oregonians, and how to help. As always, Coast Range Radio is free on all podcast apps, which is a great way to share this episode. My email is coastrangeradio@gmail.com. Let me know what you think of the show. Well, Rick Pope and Sue Palmeter, welcome to Coast Range Radio.
Thanks. Thanks, Zach. We are happy to be here with you.
So I've been following you all and you all's work for a while now, but for folks who aren't familiar, tell me a little bit about the mission of Divest Oregon.
Divest Oregon started about 4 years ago, and our mission with our 100 coalition organization members is to focus on following the money in the fossil fuel industry and the climate crisis. And that the biggest pot of money in the state of Oregon that is invested in fossil fuels is the Oregon State Treasury. $100 billion is in that purse. Public employee retirement system, and a chunk of that, 5 to 10 billion, are invested in fossil fuels. And so that has been our mission, to get that Oregon Treasury to divest from those fossil fuel holdings, along with many other state pension funds in the country, to really move the needle.
Real quick, how do folks get involved? And then tell me a little bit about why divestment, why focus on that, and how you pick your targets.
Divest Oregon, the best way to contact us and to find out more about us and join us is on the Divest Oregon website, divestoregon.org. And there's just a lot of information, reports, our 100 coalition organizations, you can see who they are. And there's a big join button in the corner to get our emails. And we'd be happy to have anybody join us and learn more.
And then before we get into the Treasury, like I said, why, just tell listeners, you know, why strategically focus on divestment and how you kind of pick the targets, the things you want to focus on?
Yeah, there's a lot of money that's being funneled into the fossil fuel industry. And the fossil fuel industry is, you know, emitting the carbon dioxide that is our problem child with climate change. And so we are focusing there. And if the investments move to a greener economy and renewables and so forth, we could start moving this ship more quickly. But as we know, we are fast approaching tipping points and cascade effects that are going to affect our generation and future generations. So we're just trying to move as quickly as possible to a greener economy that allows for a sustainable planet.
Yeah.
Online. Yeah.
And Michael, this is Rick Pope. If I could add on to that, we would consider divestment to include not making new investments in fossil fuel projects. And that is particularly important because new fossil fuel projects are going to lock in emissions for decades that will be affecting us and our children and our grandchildren and our economy and our pension values for decades.
That's a great point. You know, we see all of this infrastructure that already exists, but the fossil fuel industry is still investing hundreds of billions of dollars, maybe trillions of dollars, much of it public money, our taxpayer money, into new investments, not just keeping up what's going on. So thanks for bringing that in. I want to talk about some of the campaigns that you all are working on specifically. But first, let's talk about the Oregon Treasury and the state treasurer. So before I ask why and what's wrong with them, in so many words, what does the Treasury do? You touched on this, but expand just a bit.
The Oregon State Treasurer, who is Elizabeth Steiner, was elected in November and started her tenure in January of this year, oversees many of the financial aspects of our state. And one of the biggest pot of money that she oversees is the Oregon Public Employee Retirement System. It's about the 10th largest employee retirement system in the entire country. Hmm. Even though Oregon isn't one of the largest states by capita, since all of the various public employees feed into PERS, it is one of the largest. And so they have a lot of clout around the country. Other folks look to them to see what they're doing. So when Elizabeth was elected, she is now our primary target. And we do look to them for leadership in dealing with the climate crisis, both to protect PERS fund, but also to protect climate, which affects all investments. Because all investments are going to be affected by climate change.
And do you all have numbers on how much money the state treasury has currently invested in fossil fuel projects and investments?
We did a research study. We're early on in our campaign, and it was to the tune of $4 to $7 billion. What we don't—that's B with billion with a B. What we don't know is what's going on with their private investments. Mm. So Oregon Treasury, about 55% to 60% of PERS is in private investments. That's one of the largest private investment allocations of any pension fund in the country, or perhaps the largest. And because of that, by statute, by law, and by contract, the public can't know what is invested there. Now, Treasurer Reid, past Treasurer Reid, now Secretary of State Reid, did commission an investigation on the emissions of the various portions of the PERS fund and found that there was quite a bit in the private investment portion. So we don't have dollar amounts, but we know emissions amounts, and we know that there's quite a bit of emissions throughout the portfolio, both in the public equity pieces and in the private investment portions. So we have dollar amounts and we have emissions, and it's kind of hard to really gauge exactly how much.
Right. So much of that is kind of opaque and difficult to parse out. So, you know, my sense, just following you all and you all's work, is that the Treasury and Secretary of Treasury, whoever it's been at any given time, has been really resistant to your demands and proposals. And you know, while at the same time, you know, talking at the other side of their mouth about, yes, we care about climate change and da 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 da. So what are their arguments for continued fossil fuel investments? And why are these presumably smart people with, you know, degrees and plenty of access to data so wrong about this? What are they missing?
Well, this is Rick, and I would say that they are focused on one of their duties, which by statute is to make the PERS investments as productive as possible. And they have not fully thought through the implications of climate change on their duties, which are higher priority, which is to manage the investment funds prudently and to impartially protect the pensions of future beneficiaries, future retirees, young people in their 20s and 30s and 40s working for as public employees now, to protect those pensions equally as importantly as today's retirees. And they're just not trained to do that. They're not used to thinking that way. And the problem is with climate change, it's going to have some very big impacts on the economy and thus on our investment values that they're not really considering.
So what do they say? You know, when you come to them with your proposals or we want you to do this, that, or the other, what is their argument?
Well, if we can make money today, that's what we're obligated to do and not think about the future too far down the road. And the people who are in charge, the policymakers, have a term that's usually just a few years. And I think that, you know, they probably feel that if they do an okay job while they're in that role for a few years, things are great. But the problem is with climate change, you can't afford to think that way anymore. You've got to look down the road.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Sue.
Yeah. And I think the other thing I would state is they have been a primary target and we have made progress. The previous treasurer created a net zero plan saying that they were going to alleviate their fossil fuel holdings either by probably not by divestment, but increasing their green investments and having attrition with their fossil fuel holdings. And with the current treasurer, Steiner, has HB 2081, which will have a vote tomorrow in the Senate committee and probably on the Senate floor, I'm thinking shortly after, which says that they must start looking at climate change as part of the risk to the portfolio and report on it every 2 years. I don't believe that we would have gotten the net zero plan from Treasurer Reid or this bill from Treasurer Steiner without the pressure from the Divest Oregon Coalition. So we are making progress. We, of course, would like to see that progress more quickly, but we are seeing some progress over at the Treasury, and we'll continue to keep pushing that agenda.
And you're actually foreshadowing a topic I want to get into later, which is some of the strategy and shifting kind of the window of conversation. So hopefully we'll have time to dig into that a little bit more. Let's jump into what you all are working on now and have been working on recently. So I'm tracking at least three different big campaigns you all are working on. One, the PAWS Act legislation that I believe is not going to make it through this legislative session. I do want to ask about that. You have a big climate risk review report that you just debuted that I think we probably will spend some time on, and then a Green 529 petition. And if there's anything else, we can get into those as well. But I was hoping to start on the PAWS Act. So if that's okay with you, we'll start there. So what is or was the PAWS Act? And then we'll go into what happened in the legislature.
The PAWS Act was a bill, and I'll use it in the past tense since it won't be moving forward. It was an attempt for this campaign to really focus on those private investments I mentioned earlier. We're very concerned about new investments in fossil fuel infrastructure, LNG terminals, and new pipelines, and so forth. As Rick mentioned earlier, that's a real risk to the portfolio to continue to build new elements that are going to continue to cause greater climate chaos, but also that will probably be stranded assets by the time they're finally built and put into place. So they're both a risk to the climate, but they're a risk to the portfolio. And so the PAWS Act was to say, stop new investments in private investments that are fossil fuel related. Candidate Steiner, when she was running for the Treasury, said that she thought that was a good idea. And we were very hopeful that the treasurer would support the bill. Unfortunately, they made a choice to not support it, and they opposed it. And we are really disappointed in that. We believe that there is no way that they can get to net zero without stopping those investments in new private fossil fuel investments. So we are hopeful that as part of the work that they claim they will be doing in the next year, that they will be looking at their private investments and instituting what we would call the PAWS Act, even if we didn't get that bill passed, and we will be putting a lot of pressure on them to do that. I would say that with all the bills we've introduced with Divest Oregon, the four bills that we've introduced, all of them have moved the Treasury forward. Only one was passed, the Coal Act, last year, but all four, I think, have made positive progress forward at the Treasury. So we're disappointed about Senate Bill 681, the PAWS Act, but we believe we will see some movement with that.
And just to put a fine point on it, so the PAWS Act would have enacted a moratorium, correct? A five-year moratorium on PERS investments in fossil fuel funds. And so, I mean, to me, that it's so disappointing that in Oregon, where we have a Democratic trifecta, where you have a Treasury Secretary who said that she at least, and I'm not privy to what language she used, but in your opinion, was supportive of the concept at least. Like, this is something I think I was going to get to in a little bit, but it's so frustrating that in this state, where we liked, and I was actually just talking with Representative Mark Gamba about this on a recent episode, like, why does Oregon Democratic leadership keep killing these good climate bills? And like you say, this is just, this is seems smart from an economic perspective as well. Like, any person can tell that this stuff is not going to be a good investment in the long term. So what is going on with our leadership?
I think that's the million, billion dollar question, Michael. And if you could answer that for me, that's the question I get asked by a lot of folks is we've got a supermajority. What's going on with our climate bills this session?
And yeah.
It's very disheartening. We know from Divest Oregon, at least, that if the treasurer doesn't support, our legislators feel like they're the smart ones in the room, as you mentioned mm-hmm. earlier, and so that they should be able to figure out what to do. We would disagree. And we think the legislature does have a role to play in what's going on at Treasury. And clearly the treasurer feels that way as well with her HB 2081. So we do know the legislature has a role to play, and we think that they need to be stronger in that role.
Yeah. I mean, I'm curious if you all have, though, seriously, an opinion on this, because I think the younger me would have said, oh, they're corrupt, it's, you know, fossil fuel money, and that may be the case, but that's not my first instinct now, you know. But Rick, I see you putting your hand up, so please enlighten me.
Who knows for certain, but it looks to us like the hidebound thinking that you're describing really emanates from the bureaucratic staff in the Treasury, the investment bureaucracy, who have been trained since they were in school to always look for the most money you can make right away.
Mm.
And if anything gets in the way of that, they don't want to be bothered with it, even though there's all kinds of replacement investments that you could make for fossil fuel investments that would do as well, better for the most part, and protect the pension fund in downtimes and different kinds of times. They don't want to have that extra burden, and they really don't want anybody questioning their expertise.
Well, that's a really interesting point you're making. I mean, you know, obviously classical mainstream capitalist economics is kind of what got us into this whole mess in the first place to some degree. Although I don't want to let the politicians off the hook, because there are certainly climate bills that aren't running through the Treasury that keep getting killed as well. So something's happening there where we just don't have the kind of seriousness of purpose that we need. But I will let you all off the hook for trying to diagnose that that problem for now. And if you have any more to say on the PAWS Act, feel free. Otherwise, I'd love to hear about the new climate risk review.
Well, this is the larger picture, and it fits in with the politics that you were raising, Michael. One of the bills that was in the legislature this year, which didn't make it out, was by Republicans who would have, by this bill, prevented the staff from considering any type of long-term impact of climate change on the investment values in the pension fund. So that's some of the counter pressure that you're seeing, which is the fossil fuel industry is now riding high. They've got an administration that's doing everything it can to support them. And since politicians always by nature have their finger to the wind, that presumably has some effect on them. But if you just stop and start looking at what people are coming out with now and in the last 5 years, you see that there's a lot of modeling, solid financial modeling, that says if we continue on the path we're on, the climate path we're on, to 3 degrees global warming, that's going to affect our economy by somewhere between 15 and 50% by many estimates downward. And then will affect our investment values by 20 to 40% downward. And even larger if we get tipping points like the ice sheets melt and slide into the ocean, or the Atlantic changing the circulation of the Atlantic so Europe can't grow crops anymore. All of these things are coming out, and they are real risks, and they need to be considered, and they need to be addressed. And our argument is that our pension fund, particularly in line with other public pension funds, has $11 trillion and 33 million beneficiaries, and they need to be doing everything within their ability to avoid the worst climate outcomes and to avoid these risks. And we need a paradigm shift. I referred earlier to our policy board has terms of only a few years, and they need to be thinking beyond the end of their term. They need to be setting policy so that the young people who are public employees now will have as good a pension and secure a pension as today's retirees do. And the public pension system is unique because by law, it's required to do all those things. And we don't know of any other institution that by law is required to economically protect young people. And these public pension funds are required to do that.
Yeah, I would just add that our campaign has never been just about Oregon. We are one of the leaders in the country in this work, but we, as Rick is mentioning, we need to bring all these pension managers together, all these treasurers and comptrollers around the country. We have leaders in New York City with Comptroller Lander and folks in New York State and in California that are starting to lead as well. But Oregon needs to be a leader, and they need to be doing it together. If we get our pension fund cleaned up, it will be great, but it needs to be in concert with these others. And that's what this risk report really highlights, is that there needs to be concerted effort around the country to, with this huge amount of money, trillions of dollars, $11 trillion, that could be diverted from the climate crisis, fossil fuel expansion to a green economy. So that's really what this climate risk report is about, really focusing on these pension funds and how they need to be working in concert.
And working with the companies they're investing in to pressure for change sooner than it would come otherwise. Educating their beneficiaries about what could well happen to their retirements if climate change isn't addressed. And doing it in a way the beneficiaries should understand it's their pocketbook issue.
Exactly. Well, so if folks want to read the report and you also have an executive summary, you could just go to divestoregon.org, and you guys have at the top of your page a little tab that says report, and you can find the 2025 Climate Risk Review report there. I did want to ask a couple questions around the strategy and philosophy you employ. So you touched on this earlier, but even though a lot of the initiatives of Divest Oregon have not yet succeeded, you are kind of pushing the narrative, right? And moving the needle. How do you think about, you know, these concrete wins, say like a legislation versus these kind of proposals that move the needle, and how to approach that?
Right. We have, you know, an external strategy and an internal strategy. And our external strategy, you'll see our reports, you'll see our very in-depth research by someone like Rick Pope, who's brought so much, intellect and deep concentration into certain aspects. So that's our external strategy, is to get the word out, get the reports out, get the information to the public. And then we have that internal strategy. So we are in constant communication with the Treasury and the Oregon Investment Council about what they're doing and what they should be doing and what they can do. So that's kind of our strategic approach to work both of those channels. And so we really do try to understand where they're coming from and where we can try to inject some other thinking. We do believe that our work isn't just based in Oregon. We are part of a coalition and a network in the country. And so we're working with other states in their work, sharing our reports, sharing our techniques and strategies so that we can move other campaigns along as well. So that's kind of, we have the local strategy, the national strategy, both internal and external. That's kind of how we're working it. And I think it is moving the conversation forward. Of course, we would want it to be much faster.
Yeah.
But it appears, especially in legislative and in financial worlds, things move slowly. So we are, you know, we're just pushing along here.
Yeah.
And really appreciate this opportunity to talk about it with Michael.
Well, I appreciate being able to talk with you all and hear about it. And before I let you go, on this, you know, kind of strategy thinking, you just mentioned, you know, how you kind of have an inside and outside strategy. And Obviously, one thing that happens when we work the inside game, working with politicians and with bureaucrats, is there's obviously tremendous potential benefit there, but then we can also get sucked into being kind of slow-walked, right? And so how do you balance trying to act in good faith collaboration with someone like the Treasury with that need to push them and be oppositional at times and not let them kind of rope you into that slow walk? Oh yeah, I support it, but just not this way, et cetera. You know, how do you balance that?
It's a really fair question, and one we ask ourselves often. And we look to New York City, who those activists have made some great strides recently with the New York City pension funds actually starting to push back on banks and insurance companies that are funding the fossil fuel crisis. That was a big breakthrough that just happened recently. And those folks have decided to do more direct action and kind of get in people's faces. And believe me, we think about that. Another opportunity when the Treasury says, well, we can't do anything because, you know, there could be a lawsuit. And I always come back with, well, what's to say that we wouldn't go ahead and force some kind of litigation because they are, you know, as far as we can tell, not taking advantage of their opportunity and their direct legal requirement to protect the younger beneficiaries that Rick's, you know, referred to here. So we, you know, we try to use a carrot and a stick as much as possible. Mm-hmm. And I completely agree that there is that risk of being slow walked. And I think we kind of try to walk that tightrope. Rick has a comment as well, I believe.
Yeah. One thing that we've always done is our homework. We've always made a serious attempts to understand how the system really works so we know what the issues really are or are really set.
You are tuned into listener-supported community radio, KBOO Portland.
Camp KBOO is in session. Sign up to support us